What did Reb Shneur Zalman tell us over here, the last few lines? What is he conveying? What is the message he is articulating? The Tanya was written brief, but when one delves into the words of the Alter Rebbe, we can gain understanding into the nature of the message he is trying to impart to us. There's a very interesting inconsistency that we discover over here. Whereas in the third chapter, when he discusses the divine soul, he first mentions the three intellectual faculties, and only following that does he discuss the seven emotional faculties. Over here, the order shifts. He says it possesses 10 crowns of impurity, 7 midas, and then 3 intellectual faculties. Why this shift? Point number one. Point number two, among others, which requires clarification, is verses in chapter 3 when he discusses the divine soul, he says that the midas are toldos chabad. The emotional attributes are the outgrowth, the offspring, the young, so to speak, of Chabad, of Chachma bin Adas. Over here he says, Hamidos hein lefi erech haseichel. Over there he says, why is Chachma bin Adas the source of Midos? Because the Midos are an outgrowth of Seichel. Over here he says, why is the Seichel the source of Midos? Because the Midos are not an outgrowth of Seichel. Rather, they are commensurate with the quality of one Seichel. And indeed, the reason for this is, as he discusses and articulates more clearly in chapter 9 of Tanya, in the beginning of it, that this is actually very much connected to the very nature of these two souls. The animal, natural soul is impulsive by nature. The divine soul is reflective by its very nature. The animal soul acts basically on impulses. However, the object of these impulses is defined and articulated by its mind. How, what, where, and when. The divine soul doesn't act on impulses. By its very nature, it's reflective. That is the quality that defines it most. As a result of its reflection, of its intellective nature, as a consequence of that, does it generate impulses, instincts, motives, desires, and so on and so forth. And let me explain to you what I'm saying. The divine soul and the animal soul are very, very different. The focus, the quintessence, if you will, of the animal soul is self. The I is what stands at the center of this soul. Therefore, everything that the soul experiences, engages in, does, says, thinks, feels, understands, ultimately is motivated by the need, by the quest for self-enhancement, for self-fulfillment, for self-preservation, for self. That is the essence of the experience of that soul. That is the axiom, the pinpoint from which everything comes, from which everything stems, and everything evolves, revolves one way or another around this center. It's egocentric by its very nature. Its whole identity focuses on self. That is the axiom. That, by definition, means that its true nature, its essential nature, is a midas dika, is an impulsive one, rather than a seichel dika, rather than a reflective one. What is the difference when you talk about a person who acts on his impulses, an impulsive person, or a person who's a reflective person? What is the difference? An impulsive person does not think before he engages in something, before he does something, is this the proper thing to do? No, he acts on his impulses. There is no vision, there is no backbone that is guiding and directing his activities. The reflective person waits. Don't say it because you were suddenly angered or provoked to say it, think for a moment before you say something, before you do something, before you take something, before you give something, and so on and so forth. The Nefesh HaBahamas, with all its sophistication and with all its ability of comprehension and understanding, is ultimately impulsive by its very nature. Why? What guides it ultimately? A true vision of what reality is? No. Your sense of self. I want to be enhanced. I want to feel good. I want to be preserved. Everything runs around that. That's not called true reflection. There is an axiom that transcends the reflection, that precedes the reflection. The reflection is only a byproduct, a garment that comes after that natural, essential makeup of yours that I stand at the center. But who said that you are the center? Who said that you have to be self-enhanced? Who said that you have to be self-preserved? Who says that everything comes from you and goes to you? That the animal soul doesn't answer. Once that axiom was stated, was created, then it uses its mind, its logic, its rationale to manipulate its way through life and achieve the maximum it can achieve in order to enhance that self. That is not called seicheldik. Just to give an extreme example. If someone wants money, or he needs money, and the only way he's going to get that money is by cheating his colleague and performing a theft, an act of theft. And this guy is smart, he's intelligent, so he knows how to manipulate his way, and he uses his mind to cheat his colleague in business and to get his money. Was this a reflective act or an impulsive act? Was this an act which was motivated by seichel or by midos? At first glance, you'll say it was very seicheldik. It was very logical. A lot of intellect was imbued in this act. There was a lot of mind which was enclosed in this activity. But of course, upon deeper reflection, that's ridiculous. Why? If he was guided by intellect, one second. Intellect asks, is not bias. Intellect, its definition is, it seeks the true nature of everything. That's the difference between intellect and impulses. Impulses means that something is established, and you're just following to implement that, to fulfill that. True intellect means no. You want to understand. You want to understand the true nature of things. True intellect is objective by its very nature. If it's objective by its very nature, that is what true intellect is all about. So wait a moment. Who said that you should steal? That you don't ask. The fact that you, because you need money, the fact that you need the money, and the fact, therefore, in order to do that, you have to steal, that there's no questions asked. That's a fact given. The question is asked, that was established. What's the best way to do it? So the mind over here became subservient. It was just manipulated by a subjective fact that is the foundation of your reality, and it's just being used for that. That's an extreme example. But basically, the whole character of the Nefesh HaBahamas, of the animal soul, is this. There is an axiom established, not an objective phenomenon, a subjective phenomenon, a subjective perspective, that I am at the center of reality. And therefore, I do and I engage in everything to fulfill that. Now the mind is being utilized and manipulated to fulfill that. So over here you have a difference between a child and an adult. That's what he's saying. The middais alafi erech haseichel. Essentially, the nature of this soul is a middais dika one, is a subjective, impulsive one. However, man has a mind, so he uses that mind. The reason why a child loves something and an adult loves something is not because the vision dictates so. It's because they both love things that do them good. Now the mind comes and the child's mind will say, listen, this candy is going to enhance your ego. The adult's mind will tell him, this candy won't enhance your ego. This car, this money, this home, this will enhance your ego. So go after this. So the middais are lefi erech haseichel. But the actual essence of the middais are dictated by themselves, not by the seichel. Now we come to the divine soul, however. Divine soul works the other way around. Over there, the essence of the soul is a seicheldika one, is a reflective one. Over there, the soul seeks truth. That is the essence of the soul. The fact that the adult and the child both love something that is good, that is already a subjective foundation that was created by Midas. Who says that you have to love something that's good for you? Maybe you should love something that's good for someone else. You never thought of that. Why? Because we only usually tap into that element of ourselves. And that element created axioms. And that is, I am at the center of things. That's it. A foundation. A first foundation. That's the point of it. And now everything follows that. Maybe you're not at the center of things if you're really objective. The mind goes a step further. If it's a real mind, who said that you're everything? And who said that everything begins with you and ends with you? And who even said that the mind is everything? The mind even questions itself if it's a true mind. It searches the truth of things, the true reality of things. This is the nature of the divine soul. So the emotional attributes of the divine soul are generated, are created because the mind guides it and directs it based on vision. And everyone could look at their own life and look through what we do during the day and see how many things that we do are done as the product of a pre-formulated vision that we had in our mind. And these actions and activities are implementing that vision. Or, perhaps most of the things we do in our life are impulsive by their very nature. This moment comes up, so you have to do this. This moment comes up, so you have to do this. This is the difference between the divine soul and the animal soul. And this is why, in Perek Gimel, in the third chapter, he discusses Seichel before Midas. Over here, in this chapter, he discusses Midas before Seichel. Over there also, he says that the Midas are the offspring of Chabad. Over here, the Midas are not the offspring of Chabad. The Midas are just in comparison with the quality of your Seichel. Is it clear? Any questions? Huh? You're asking if this is the reason why when it discusses Midas, he says, Sheva Midas Rais. Seven negative Midas. When it comes to Seichel, he doesn't use the term Rais, negativity or evilness. So how are you trying to explain that? What? So you're saying because the Seichel itself is not the Ra, but it's just the Midas that are conveying it. Perhaps it's possible, of course, that the negativity of the Seichel is much more subtle than the negativity of the Midas, because Seichel doesn't actually directly dictate behavior. It's the Midas that create behavior. But nevertheless, that's specifically speaking, but generally speaking, as he says, all of them are 10 crowns of impurity. But perhaps specifically that's the reason. I'm not sure. What about the highest crown of all? The Keter. Over here, when he discusses the 10 characteristical traits of the human personality, he begins the system with Chachma, which is the first of the 10, conception. He does not discuss or elaborate on the sphere of Keser, which transcends the 10 elements, and one of the reasons is because usually the sphere of Keter is much more connected with the subconscious forces and elements in the human being's reality, which are often beyond our control to refine, elevate, and guide. Yeah. How do these two how does this concept coincide with those two realities that are known throughout Chazal as Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara, the good inclination and the evil inclination? It's not two distinct elements, but rather the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara, as explained in many places, are part of these two elements called the divine soul and the animal soul, specifically the emotional faculties and motives of the divine soul are defined as the Yetzer Tov. The Yetzer Hara is the emotional element of the animal soul. So the nefesh, the soul, would be more all-encompassing. Not only is it an inclination, but it's an entire persona and character, which includes, of course, inclinations and motives and instincts. And the Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara is a certain element of it. Yeah. 1 second, yeah. Go on. Okay, you're asking, in connection with what we spoke in the beginning of this year about learning Torah Lishma, if the same applies also concerning mitzvahs, for example, the mitzvah of charity, if the best way is to give charity for its own sake versus giving charity to get something out of it. So the truth is that this discussion is beyond the scope of the present class and discussion, but certainly, just in a word, Lishma, the best way of performing both the mitzvah of learning Torah and observing the mitzvahs is when they're done lishma. Nevertheless, our sages say that even if someone is going to learn Torah and observe mitzvahs not lishma, it's also good and it should be encouraged, because the deed itself and the Torah itself is a valuable accomplishment and achievement. By the way, where did you say you saw in chapter 6 about tzedakah? Which chapter?
In Proverbs. In Proverbs.
Are you not talking about the Tanya? Oh, Epistle 6. That's the second section of Tanya. There are several sections in Tanya. The Tanya has five sections, and that's chapter 6 of the fourth section, the Epistles, the Epistle 6. Now we're learning the first section, chapter 6. Oh, I didn't understand the connection, why you're talking about charity. I was wondering. Okay, fine. We might get there one day. But don't hold your breath. Yeah, go ahead.
I was wondering about, you mentioned the subconscious. Does the subconscious for a human being connect, sort of like in the philosophy of Jung, to the divine mind of God? In that sense, where there's an infinity, so to speak, God.
You want to know if the subconscious doctrine articulated in the Tanya is similar to the subconscious doctrine articulated by Jung, by Dr. Jung? That's it's a very good question indeed, to discuss the parallels and the differences between the subconscious forces in the thought of Reb Shneur Zalman and the subconscious forces in the thought and philosophies, doctrines of Dr. Jung, Dr. Freud, Dr. Adler, and so on and so forth. But it's beyond the scope of the present class. Okay. So till now, the Alter Rebbe articulated, albeit briefly, the 10 faculties of the soul, which are the counterpart of the same 10 faculties in the divine soul. And now he continues to discuss the garments, the three mediums of expressions. Ve'esher b'chinas elu hatmeyus. Now these 10 unclean categories, kisha'adam echashev behen emedaber ayos, when a person thinks, thoughts originating from them, or speaks words originating from them, or does an act which serves or expresses them. Then the thought in his brain, the words in his mouth, and the power of action in his hands and other organs are called impure garments for these 10 unclean categories, which clothe themselves in these garments during the act, speech, or thought. In other words, when a human being uses his faculty of thought, which exists in every body, in every brain, or the faculty of speech, or the faculty of action in the hands or other organs, he can use it either, these very same faculties, to dress the divine soul, to serve as a medium of expression from the divine soul, or he can use them as garments for the animal, for the natural soul. So when a human being thinks thoughts, says words, or does actions that express the nature of the animal soul, they express the character, the identity, the motives, the instincts, the wishes, the feelings, the understanding process of the animal soul, what occurs at that time is that his organs of these three faculties of thought, speech, and action can be defined as the levushim of the nefesh ha-bahamis, as the garments of the animal soul. Of course, only at that time when he is using these faculties for expressing the animal soul. Yeah. How do you distinguish and know when the thought and speech and action are serving the divine soul and when they're serving the animal soul? You're saying there's a gray area. What is that gray area? It's confusing to know what comes from what? Huh? It's confusing to know what's right and wrong. Yeah, 1 second. What do you want to say? For example, if someone eats, a person has to eat to sustain his body. Where is the tumma? Where is the impurity, the uncleanliness that characterizes eating? Yeah?
I would say the answer to that question is a person's when they're doing something, for example, eating, you could eat like a chaser, or you can eat because you're hungry and eat because you're going on to do bigger and better mitzvahs, not going on to
So you're saying that you're suggesting that the difference would be what your intention behind the eating is.
Or any action.
If it's part and parcel of your divine service, L'shem Shamayim, or it is just fulfilling an egotistical need. Okay, yeah.
The way I see it, as far as eating is good, which we all have to do, but are we sanctifying and blessing God and thanking Him for giving us the food? He who is the source of all, the divine within us, and he's giving us the food. He's the one that is actually giving it to us. We're not just like animals. God is the one that gives us the food. And we have to thank Him and bless Him and sanctify Him before eating. And afterwards also.
Okay, so you're suggesting that a difference would be if someone just eats for the sake of eating, or eats with the preface of thanking God for it, blessing God for it, and realizing that He is the master of the food and the master of the universe. Okay, Reb Shneur Zalman, very well aware of this problem, immediately in the next words addresses this dilemma. They tell the story about the two brothers, the holy Reb Elimelech of Luzhensk and the holy Reb Zusha of Anipali. They were both colleagues of Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the author of the Tanya. Both learned to Mezritch, students of the great Maggid of Mezritch, the pupil of the founder of Hasidism, the Baal Shem Tov. In fact, before the Alter Rebbe allowed the Tanya to go to print, he conditioned the publication of the Tanya upon receiving two approbations, and one of them was from Reb Zusha of Anipali, who was a senior colleague friend of the Alter Rebbe and lived in the city of Anapoli where he's actually interred. These two brothers, Rebbe Elimelech and Rebbe Zusha, wandered for many, many years the back roads of Galicia. They journeyed from town to town, from village to village, from city to city, refining their souls with the difficulties of exile, of galus, which was a common practice at that time, where Jews, saintly Jews, would wander from town to town to refine their souls through these trialing journeys, and also inspiring their Jewish brethren with words of wisdom and encouragement. Late one evening, Reb Zusha and Reb Melech arrived in the town of Ludmir. Seeing a lighted window far away in a large, well-appointed home, they immediately went to the home and knocked on the door. And they asked the person who came to the door if they could stay here for just one night, and immediately in the morning they will leave. "I don't run a hotel." The man who came to the door immediately responded, "This is a home of a private person. This is not a place for guests. But there's a poor house near the shul for wandering beggars. I'm sure they will be able to find two beds for you, and there will be no trouble to find accommodations for you two people." The heavy door was almost slammed in their face, and Rebbe Elimelech and Rebbe Zusha walked on. Soon they came upon another lighted house. They knocked on the door. The resident of this home was a scribe, and he welcomed them into his little humble hut. And no problem, stay here. And on the contrary, he assisted them, and all the resources he had, he put at their disposal. Several years later, Reb Melech and Reb Zusha were already revealed, so to speak, famous rabbis, teachers, masters, and rebbes in their respective cities. The two brothers again visited Ludmir. This time, however, not like the previous time, they were official guests of the community who requested that the two rebbes come to the city for a Shabbos to grace the town with their presence, to teach, to inspire, to encourage, to bless, and so on and so forth. After Reb Zusha and Reb Melech addressed the entire crowd in the huge Beis Medrash, in the huge study hall, a man, a very distinguished man from the community, came over to them and he said, "My dear Rebbes, the town council has granted me the privilege to have you as guests. In my home, you will be lacking nothing. Whatever you need, whatever you want, you will have there. I've already explained to your coachman how to get there, although he is sure not to miss it because everyone knows where I live." The gathering dispersed. Reb Zusha and Reb Melech went to pay respect to the town rabbi, meet with some local scholars in the small Beis Medrash of the town. The rich man went home to make the final arrangements for the distinguished guest, Reb Zusha and Reb Melech. In the meantime, the coachman came to him, and he immediately placed the luggage that they brought into the room that he designated for the rebbes. He immediately placed the horses in the stable, and he placed the coachman in the coachman's quarter, where he had in the servant's quarter to settle over there. 1 hour passed, 2 hours passed, several hours passed. The two brothers are not showing up. Growing anxious, he finally runs over to the coachman, the wealthy man, the host, and he says, "What happened?" He asked them. "Hours have passed already. I told them where I am. When are they going to come here?" "Oh," the coachman responded to him, "they're not coming here," he says. "They are staying at the scribe's house." "What? I don't understand. Why are they staying at the scribe's house?" "I don't know. I followed instructions. Reb Zusha and Reb Melech told me that they were invited by you. I should stay by you. The horses should stay by you. The luggage should stay by you. No problem. But they themselves are going to the scribe's home." He immediately ran out that home. He came running to the scribe's home. He almost broke down the entire door. He comes in, he runs into the scribe, and he sees that Reb Zusha and Reb Melech are sitting calmly on the broken chairs he had in his humble hut, and they're drinking tea. He shouted, he cried, he said, "Honored Rebbes, what have you done to me? It was I who was granted the privilege to host you. It was I who was granted the privilege to be hospitable to you, to have you in my home. You must tell me, what have I done to deserve this humiliation?" Reb Elimelech responded and he said, "I don't understand. What are you crying about? You are hosting us. At least that part of us that you desire to host. You see, last time we were here, but we were here without a coach, without horses, without coachmen, without several pairs of clean clothes to change, and then you turned us away from the door, you threw us out of here. In other words, it is not us who you want. You want our coachmen, you want our horses, you want our luggage, you want our beautiful garments, and you are currently enjoying their hospitality. They are all currently enjoying your hospitality. Reb Shnei Zalman is telling us over here in this chapter that our organs, our faculties of thought, speech, and action can either be the hosts of the horses that find themselves in our lives, or they can be the hosts which will serve as the home, the domain in which the human being in us, the divine soul in us, expresses itself. The next step, I guess, is ours. Have a good night and a wonderful week.
Rabbi Jacobson delivers this weekly class on the Tanya each Sunday morning at Heichel Menachem in the Borough Park section of Brooklyn, New York. To order additional tapes or to receive the tapes weekly by mail, please call Heichel Menachem at 718-633-1076.